the missing girl's pictures, and composite drawings of Ted. The phone jangled continually. Thousands of names, thousands of tips. Somewhere in that plethora of information, there might be the one lead to the real Ted. But where? Captain Nick Mackey took a brief vacation, a 2-day hunting trip. As he climbed a hill in eastern Washington, he was felled by the first of the heart attacks, which would eventually mean the end of his career in law enforcement. No one who had watched him agonize over the girl's disappearances, who had seen him work 10-hour days, doubted that the strain had contributed to his coronary. He was only 42. Mackey recovered and was back to work within a few weeks, and the search for the smiling tan man in the white tennis outfit continued without let-up. Ted Bundy had returned to Seattle in mid-September and was back in Utah within a few days, ready to begin law classes at the University of Utah. He'd found an apartment in a big old dormered house at 565 First Avenue in Salt Lake City, a house quite similar to the Rogerses where he'd lived in Seattle. He moved into number 2 and soon had it decorated to his satisfaction. He got a job as a night dormitory manager on campus, and his new life had begun. He could make ends meet by getting a partial rent decrease for managing the building where he lived, and he drew $2.10 an hour at the dorm. Soon he had a better-paying job as a campus security officer at the University of Utah. He still phoned Meg often, but he met many new women in Utah. There was Callie Fiore, a fey, almost kooky, freckled girl who lived in the house on First Avenue. Sharon Auer, who was a law student. Another pretty girl who lived in Bountiful just north of Salt Lake City. Much later, when I would see him again, when he had become the number one suspect in so many killings and disappearances, he asked me, "Why should I want to attack women? I had all the female companionship I wanted. I must have slept with at least a dozen women that first year in Utah, and all of them went to bed with me willingly." I didn't doubt it. Women had always liked Ted Bundy. Why indeed would he have needed to take any woman by force? During that fall of 1974, I had no knowledge whatsoever of criminal activity in Utah. It was hundreds of miles from my territory, and I was kept busy dealing with cases in the Northwest. I had learned that I would have to have major surgery, elective, but something that couldn't wait. It would mean that I wouldn't be able to work for at least a month. I had no choice but to write twice as many stories so that I could bank enough to see us through. Had I had either the inclination, the opportunity, or the time to investigate events around Salt Lake City during that fall, I would have read about cases that bore an eerie parallel to those seemingly ended in Washington. The siege of horror did seem to be over. By October, 3 months had passed, and there had been no more disappearances of young women. Detectives doubted that the killer had overcome his compulsion, had exorcised the devils that drove him. Rather, they felt that he was either dead, incarcerated in some other area, or that he had moved on. Chapter 13. It was October 18, 1974, a Friday evening, when 17-year-old Melissa Smith, daughter of Midvale's police chief, Lewis Smith, prepared to attend a slumber party. Melissa was a little girl, 5'3", 105 pounds, very pretty, and she wore her long, light brown hair parted in the middle. She was a cautious girl, more so because of her father's profession. She had been warned again and again. Lewis Smith had seen too much violence and tragedy not to be afraid for Melissa and her sister. Melissa had planned to leave for the all-night party at a girlfriend's home early in the evening, but when she phoned her friend's home, there was no answer. So she was still at home when another friend called her in distress over a lover's spat. The friend was at work at a pizza parlor, and Melissa promised to walk over and talk to her. Wearing blue jeans, a blouse with a blue flowered pattern, and a navy blue shirt, Melissa left home alone. Midvale is a hamlet of 5,000 people, located just south of Salt Lake City, a quiet, solidly Mormon community. It's a good place to raise kids. And Melissa, although warned, had never had reason to be afraid. The walk to the pizza parlor meant negotiating shortcuts, down a dirt road and a dirt bank, under a highway overpass and a railroad bridge, and across a school playfield. Melissa arrived to comfort her friend and stayed at the restaurant until a little after 10. She had planned to return home, pick up her night clothes, and go to the slumber party. Her chosen route home would be the same shortcut she'd taken hours before. Melissa never reached home. No one saw her after she walked out of the lighted parking lot of the pizza parlor. It would be 9 days before her body was found near Summit Park, many miles east of Salt Lake City, in the Wasatch Mountains, long since discarded by her killer. Pathologist Serge Moore performed the autopsy on the battered body found nude in the Lonely Mountains. She had been beaten savagely, possibly with a crowbar, about the head. Melissa had sustained depressed fractures on the left side and back of her head and massive subdural hemorrhages. Her body was covered with bruises which had occurred prior to death. She had also been strangled by ligature. Someone had tightened her own dark blue stocking around her neck so cruelly that the hyoid bone was fractured. Melissa had been raped and sodomized. Sheriff Delmar Swede Larson of Salt Lake County and Captain N.D. Pete Hayward, a longtime homicide detective and now chief of his unit, assigned principal responsibility for the Melissa Smith murder investigation to Detective Jerry Thompson. It was not an easy case. No one had actually seen Melissa walk off into the shadows beyond the parking lot. No one had seen anyone with her or near her, and she had not been found for 9 days. Her killer could be halfway around the world. As far as physical evidence, they had only the girl's body. There had been so little blood beneath it that it was probable she had been killed elsewhere. But where? The investigation into Melissa's murder was still a night and day probe on Halloween, 4 days after her body was found. On October 31st, some 25 miles south in Lehi, Utah, 17-year-old Laura Aim, disappointed at the lack of excitement on Halloween night, left a cafe and headed for a nearby park. It was a little after midnight. Laura Aim was almost 6 feet tall and weighed only 115 pounds. Her model-like slimness seemed to her to be awkward skinniness instead. She'd dropped out of school and had moved in with friends in American Fork, working at one low-paying job after another. But she had maintained almost daily contact with her family, who lived in Salem, Utah. When Laura vanished on Halloween night, her parents didn't even know she was missing. They didn't know for 4 days, not until they called her friends home to see why she hadn't been in touch with them. "Laura isn't here," was the response. "We haven't seen her since she left on Halloween." The Ames were frightened. Her mother had warned her to be careful, that she must stop her practice of hitchhiking when the news of Melissa Smith's murder had filled the headlines, and Laura had assured her that she was quite capable of taking care of herself. Now Laura herself was missing. The pretty long-haired girl, the drifter in search of something to hold on to, had walked off into the night wearing only blue jeans and a sleeveless striped sweater. Had it been a normally cold winter, the place where they found Laura Aim would have long since been covered by a blanket of snow. But it was a mild Thanksgiving day when hikers set out through American Fork Canyon on November 27th. They found her body there in the Wasatch Mountains on a river's bank below a parking lot. She was naked, battered so that her face was unrecognizable. Her father identified her on that bleak Thanksgiving day in the morgue. He recognized some old scars on her forearm, scars left from the time her horse tossed her into some barbed wire when she was 11. The postmortem exam of Laura Ames' body, performed by Dr. Moore, elicited conclusions much like those in the autopsy on Melissa Smith. Laura Aim had depressed skull fractures on the left side and back of her head, and she had been strangled. The necklace she had worn when she vanished was caught in the nylon stocking that had been used as a ligature and was still cinched tightly around her neck. She had countless facial contusions, and her body bore deep abrasions where it had been dragged. The weapon used to inflict the skull fractures appeared to have been an iron crowbar or pry bar. Laura Aim had also been sexually assaulted. Swabs taken from her vagina and anus showed the presence of non-motil sperm. It was far too late to determine the blood type of the man who had killed her by the dead ejaculate that he had left. Blood tests indicated no sign of drugs, but did show that the teenager might have been under the influence of alcohol at the time of her death. The reading was just over 0.1, a legal indicator of intoxication, but not necessarily so profound that she would have been unable to protect herself, run, or scream. But a scream on Halloween night might have gone unnoticed. If Laura Aim had called for help, no one had heard her. Ted Bundy's Seattle girlfriend, Meg Anders, and her friend Lynn Banks had both been raised in Ogden, Utah, and Lynn had been home for a visit during the fall of 1974. She'd read of the two murdered women, looked at their pictures, and seen the physical resemblance to the Washington victims. When she got back to Seattle, she confronted Meg with her suspicions. Meg looked through the newspaper clippings that Lynn had brought back with her, and she drew a sigh of relief when she read that Melissa Smith had disappeared on the night of October 18th.
"There, see? October 18th. I talked to Ted that night about 11 o'clock. He was looking forward to going hunting with my dad the next day. He was in a good mood."
Lynn, a tiny woman, inches under 5 feet, was far more persuasive than her diminutive size would indicate, and she was frightened enough to be insistent this time.
"You have to go to the police. There are too many things that you and I both know. You can't keep hiding from it any longer."
Meg Anders did contact the King County Police in the fall of 1974. Her information about Ted Bundy resulted in the fourth listing of his name among the thousands turned in. Mine had been the first, and like mine and the others, the information did not warrant particular scrutiny. Meg had kept most of her fears to herself in her first call to the detectives. It was Lynn's urging which made Meg turn on her lover, but that friendship with Lynn also ended because of Lynn's animosity toward Ted. Ted himself had no idea that Meg had contacted the investigators. Melissa Smith's body had been found, and Laura Aim was still missing on Friday evening, November 8, 1974. It was raining that night in the Salt Lake City area, a fine misty rain that promised to become a prolonged downpour. It wasn't a particularly propitious night for a shopping trip, but 18-year-old Carol Durant headed toward the Fashion Place shopping mall in suburban Murray, Utah anyway. She drove her new Camaro, leaving home a little after 6:30 p.m. Carol had graduated from high school in the spring of 1974 and taken a job with the Mountain Bell Telephone Company. She still lived at home with her parents. A frequent shopper at the mall, she had nothing to fear as she parked her car in the parking lot. She was going to shop at Auerbach's and just browse. She ran into some cousins, chatted with them for a while, made her purchase at Auerbach's, and was leafing through some books at Walden's bookstore when she looked up to see a handsome man standing beside her. He was well-dressed in a sports jacket, green slacks, and cordovan-colored patent leather shoes. He had wavy brown hair and a mustache. He asked her if she had parked her car in the lot near the Sears store, and she nodded. Then he inquired as to her license number, and she gave it to him. He seemed to recognize it. He told her that a shopper had reported that someone had been trying to break into her car using a wire coat hanger.
"Would you mind coming with me so we can check to see if anything has been stolen?"
She was taken by surprise. It didn't occur to her to wonder how the man with the mustache had found her, how he could have known that she was the owner of the Camaro. His manner was such that she assumed he must be a security guard or a policeman. She followed him meekly through the lighted central corridor of the mall and out into the rainy night. She became apprehensive as they walked through the parking lot, but the man seemed so in control, explaining that his partner probably already had the thief in custody.
"Perhaps you'll recognize him if you see him," he told her easily.
She asked to see his identification, and he only chuckled. Carol Durant had been trained to trust police officers, and she felt somewhat foolish for having questioned the man. She opened her car with her keys and glanced around the interior.
"It's all here. There's nothing missing. I don't think he managed to get in," she told him.
The man wanted her to open the passenger door, too, and she demurred. There was nothing missing, and she saw no need. She was surprised when he tried that door anyway, shrugged and led her back to the mall, telling her that they would confer with his partner. He glanced around.
"They must have gone back to our substation. We'll meet them there and identify him."
"How would I know him?" she argued. "I wasn't even there. I was inside, shopping."
The man brushed off her objections, hurrying faster now, past many stores, and out into the darkness of the north parking lot. She asked his name, growing impatient and wary. She hadn't lost anything, and she had better things to do than follow this man on a wild goose chase.
"Officer Roseland, Murray Police Department," he answered shortly. "We're almost there."
They stood outside a door with 139 on it. He knocked, waited, and no one answered. He tried the door and found it locked. The door was a back entrance to a laundromat. It was not a police substation, but Carol didn't know that. Now the man insisted that she accompany him to headquarters to sign a complaint. He said he would drive her down in his car. She expected to see a squad car. Instead, he led her to a battered Volkswagen Bug. She had heard of unmarked cars, even sneaker cars, but this didn't look like any police vehicle she'd ever seen. She demanded to see his ID. Looking at her as if she were a hysterical female, the man grudgingly flashed his wallet, and she caught only a glimpse of a small gold badge. He put it back in his pocket so quickly that she hadn't been able to see the name of a department or even a number. He opened the passenger door and waited for her to get in. She debated refusing, but the man was impatient, and she got into his car. The moment the doors were closed, she caught the strong odor of alcohol on his breath. She didn't think policemen were allowed to drink on duty. When he instructed her to fasten her seatbelt, she said no. She was poised, ready for flight, but the car had already pulled out of the lot and was accelerating. The driver didn't head in the direction of the Murray Police Department. He was driving in the opposite direction. She looked at cars passing by them, wondered if she should scream, wondered if she should try to jump out. But they were going too fast, and no one seemed to be noticing them at all. And then the car stopped, so suddenly that it ran over a curb near the McMillan Grade School. She turned to look at Officer Roseland and saw that he was no longer smiling. His jaw was set, and he seemed removed somehow from her. When she asked him what he was doing, he didn't answer her. Carol DeRunch reached for the door handle on her side and started to jump out, but the man was too quick for her. In an instant, he had clapped a handcuff on her right wrist. She fought him, kicking, screaming, as he struggled to get the cuffs on her other wrist. He missed and managed only to get the second cuff on the same wrist. She continued to fight, scratching him, screaming at the top of her lungs, screams that went unheard in the quiet neighborhood. He was getting angrier and angrier with her. Suddenly, there was a small black gun in his hand. He held it next to her head and said, "If you don't stop screaming, I'm going to kill you. I'll blow your brains out." She fell backward out of the car onto the sodden parking strip, saw the pistol drop to the floor of the car. Now he had a crowbar of some kind in his hand, and he threw her up against the car. She put up one hand and, with the strength born of desperation, managed to keep it away from her head. She kicked at his genitals and broke free, running. She didn't see or care where. She had to get away from him. Wilbur and Mary Walsh were driving down Third Avenue East when a figure was suddenly caught in their headlights. Walsh threw on his brakes, barely missing it, and his wife fumbled with the door locks. They couldn't see who it was trying to get into their car, expecting a maniac at the very least. Then they saw that it was only a young girl, a terribly frightened girl who sobbed, "I can't believe it! I can't believe it!" Mrs. Walsh tried to comfort her, telling her that she was safe, that nothing was going to harm her now. "He was going to kill me! He said he was going to kill me if I didn't stop screaming!" The Walshes drove Carol DeRunch to the Murray Police Station on State Street. She was unable to walk, and Wilbur Walsh carried the slender girl inside, their entrance drawing startled looks from the men on duty there. As her sobs subsided to gasps, Carol told the policeman that one of their men, Officer Roseland, had attacked her. Of course, there was no Officer Roseland in the department, and no one used an old Volkswagen while on duty. They listened as she described the car, the man, the iron bar he'd used against her.
"I didn't really see it. I felt it in my hand as he tried to hit me with it. It had a lot of sides on it, more than four, I think."
She held up her right wrist, still bearing the two handcuffs. Carefully, the officers removed the cuffs, dusted them for latent prints, and came up with only useless smudges. They were not the Smith & Wesson brand usually favored by policemen, but a foreign brand, Jerichol. Patrolmen were dispatched to the site of the attack near the grade school. They found Carol DeRunch's shoe, lost in the struggle, but nothing more. The Volkswagen was, predictably, long gone. Patrol units cruised the mall, looking for a light-colored bug with dents and rust spots, with a tear in the upholstery of the rear seat. They didn't find it, nor was Murray Detective Joel Reed successful in trying to lift prints from the doorknob on door 139. Exposure to rain, even dew, can eradicate fingerprints quickly. Carol Durant looked through a pile of mug books and recognized no one. She had never seen the man before and devoutly hoped never to see him again. 3 days later, she discovered 2 small drops of blood staining the light fake fur of her jacket collar and brought the jacket in for lab testing. The blood was not hers. It was type O, but there was not enough of it to differentiate for Rh positive or negative factors. Murray detectives had a description of a man, a car, an M.O., and thank God, a live victim. The similarities between the Durant almost successful kidnapping and the murder of Melissa Smith could not be denied. Melissa had vanished from the parking lot of the pizza parlor, a restaurant only a mile away from the Fashion Place Mall. But no one knew what ruse had been used to entice her from that lot without a struggle. Her father was a policeman. Would she have gone willingly with a policeman? Probably. Whatever Officer Roseland's mission had been on the rainy night of November 8th, he had been frustrated. Carol Durant had escaped. If he had intended to rape her, or worse, his appetite had only been honed to a keener edge. He had more to do that night. 17 miles from Murray, Bountiful, Utah, is a northern suburb of the Mormon city, a suburb that lives up to its name with its natural beauty and its recreational opportunities. On November 8th, the Dean Kents of Bountiful prepared to attend a musical presented at Viewmount High School. Dean Kent had been ill, but he was feeling better, and he and his wife Belva and their oldest daughter, 17-year-old Debbie, headed for the premiere performance of The Redhead. Debbie Kent's younger brother Blair didn't care about seeing the play. He was dropped off at a roller rink, and his mother promised to pick him up at 10 p.m. Shortly before 8, they arrived at the high school. They knew most of the crowd in the auditorium. High school drama productions tend to appeal principally to the families of the performers, classmates, and friends who have been prevailed upon to buy tickets. While the audience waited in hushed expectation, Viewmount High School's drama teacher, Jean Graham, a young woman only a few years out of college herself, was approached by a stranger backstage. She was busy, distracted, trying to coordinate last-minute preparations for the performance, and she paused only briefly as the tall, slim man with the mustache called to her. She remembers that he wore a sports jacket, dress slacks, and patent leather shoes, and that he was very handsome. He was courteous, almost apologetic, as he asked her if she would accompany him to the parking lot to identify a car. She shook her head, scarcely wondering why he needed such help. She was just too busy.
"It will only take a minute," he urged.
"No, I can't. I'm in charge of the play," she said briskly, and hurried past him in the darkened hallway. He was still lingering in the hall when she headed toward the front of the auditorium 20 minutes later. "Hi," she said. "Did you find anyone to help you yet?" He didn't speak, but stared at her strangely, his eyes boring into her. Odd, she thought, but she was used to men staring at her. Her duties required that she go backstage again some minutes later, and the man was still there. He walked toward her, smiling.
"Hey, you look really nice," he complimented her. "Come on, give me a hand with that car. Just a couple of minutes will do it."
His manner was easy, cajoling, and yet she was on guard. She tried to get past him, told him that maybe her husband could help him.
"I'll go find him."
She was frightened, but that was ridiculous, she told herself. There were several hundred people close by. The man stepped to the side, blocking her way. They jockeyed for position in a peculiar side-to-side dance step, and then she was free of him. Who was he? He wasn't on the staff, too old to be a student and too young to be a parent. She hurried backstage. Debbie Kent left at intermission to phone her brother and tell him that the play wouldn't be over by 10, and then returned for the second act. One of her girlfriends, Jo Lynn Beck, noticed the handsome stranger pacing at the rear of the auditorium. Jean Graham saw him there too, and felt curiously disturbed when she saw him for the last time before the play had concluded. Debbie Kent volunteered to drive over to the roller rink and pick up her brother.
"I'll be back to pick you up," she promised her parents.
Several residents of an apartment complex across from the high school remember hearing 2 short, piercing screams coming from the west parking lot between 10:30 and 11 that night. They hadn't sounded like horseplay. They'd sounded like someone in mortal terror, screams so compelling that the witnesses had walked outside to stare over at the dark lot. They had seen nothing at all. Debbie's brother waited in vain at the bowling alley. Her parents stood impatiently in front of the high school while the crowd thinned. Finally, no one was left, but their car was still in the lot. Where was Debbie? It was midnight and they couldn't find their daughter anywhere. It seemed she'd never arrived at the car at all. They notified the Bountiful Police Department, described their daughter, 17 years old, with long brown hair parted in the middle.
She just wouldn't have left us stranded, her mother said nervously. Her father's just getting over a heart attack, and the car's still in the school lot. It doesn't make sense.
Bountiful Police had the radio report on the attempted abduction in Murray. They were all too aware of the Melissa Smith case and of the disappearance of Laura Aim. They sent patrol units out to circle the neighborhood around Viewmont High School, had the school itself opened and each room checked on the off chance that Debbie might have been accidentally locked in a room. Her parents frantically called all her friends, but no one had seen Debbie Kent. No one has ever seen Debbie Kent again. With the first thin wash of daylight the next morning, a police investigative crew searched the Viewmont High School parking lot, canvassed the neighborhood, looking for some clue to the inexplicable vanishing of Debbie Kent. They learned of the screams heard the night before, but found no actual witnesses to an abduction. There had been so many cars in the lot that no one could pick out one, perhaps a tannish old Volkswagen Bug. Bountiful detectives Ira Beale and Ron Ballantyne hunkered down to search the now empty lot. And there, between an exterior door to the school and the parking lot, they found the little key. They knew what it was, a handcuff key. They took the key at once to the Murray Police Department, inserted it in the lock of the handcuffs removed from Carol Durant. It slid in perfectly. The cuffs opened. Still, they knew that some handcuff keys are interchangeable. The key wouldn't open their Smith & Wesson cuffs, but it would work on several brands of small cuffs. It could not be considered positive physical evidence connecting the two cases, but it most certainly was alarming. Carol Durant had escaped. Apparently Debbie Kent had not. Just as in Washington State earlier in the year, the Utah law enforcement officers were inundated with calls. The last call that appeared to have any real bearing on the case came in mid-December. A man who had arrived at Viewmont High School to pick up his daughter after the play reported that he had seen an old beat-up Volkswagen, a light-colored Bug, racing from the parking lot just after 10:30 on the night of November 8th. There was no more. Debbie Kent's parents were left to face a bleak, tragic Christmas season, just as Melissa Smith's and Laura Ames were. Carol Durant was afraid to go out alone, even in the daylight.
Chapter 14. Ted Bundy was not doing as well in his first year at the University of Utah's law school as he had done in his earlier college career. He was having difficulty maintaining a C average, and he finished the quarter with two incompletes. Ted, who had breezed through tough courses at the University of Washington and graduated with distinction. Ted, who had assured the director of admissions at Utah that he was not just a qualified student, but an individual who was obstinate enough to want to become a critical and tireless student and practitioner of the law and qualified enough to succeed. Certainly he had to work to pay his way through, and that would cut into his studying time. But he was also drinking a great deal more than he had in the past. He called Meg frequently and was very disturbed when he did not find her at home. Strangely, while he was being continuously unfaithful himself, he expected, demanded that she be totally loyal to him. According to Lynn Banks, Meg's close friend, he would dial Lynn's number if he failed to find Meg at home, insisting on being told where she was. On November 18, 1974, I entered Group Health Hospital in Seattle to be prepped for surgery the next morning. I had had four babies without anesthetic, but this surgery proved to be more painful than anything in my memory, and I was sedated heavily for 2 days. I remember calling Joyce Johnson sometime in the late afternoon of November 19th, telling her that I was all right, and I remember my mother, who had come up from Salem, Oregon to stay with my children, sitting beside my bed. I also remember the deluge of flowers I received from various police departments. The Seattle homicide detective sent me a dozen red roses, and Herb Swindler appeared carrying a pot of yellow mums, followed by Ted Forrester from the King County Major Crimes Unit with a huge planter. I don't know what the nurses thought as they saw the steady parade of visiting detectives with ill-hidden gun belts at their waists. They must have thought I was a girlfriend of the mafia under surveillance. Of course, it was only a bunch of tough cops being kind. They knew I was alone and worried about getting back on my feet and able to work, and they were showing the sentimental side they usually kept hidden. Within a few days, I felt much better and rather enjoyed my notoriety. My mother visited me. She seemed worried as she remarked, "I'm glad I'm up here with the kids. You got a really strange phone call last night." "Who was it?" "I don't know. It sounded like it was long distance. Some man called you a little before midnight, and he seemed terribly upset that you weren't home. I asked if there was any message, but he wouldn't leave any, and he wouldn't say who he was."
"Upset? How upset?"
"It's hard to describe. He might have been drunk, but he seemed disoriented, panicky, and he talked rapidly. It bothered me."
"It was probably a wrong number."
"No, he asked for Anne. I told him you were in the hospital and that I could have you call him back in a day or so, but he hung up."
I had no idea who it might have been, and I would not remember the call at all until I was reminded of it almost a year later.
The Intermountain Crime Conference was held at Stateline, Nevada on December 12, 1974, and law enforcement officers met to discuss those cases which seemed to have indicators that other states might be involved. Washington detectives presented their missing and murdered girls cases, and Utah lawmen discussed Melissa Smith, Laura Aim, Debbie Kent, Carol DeRanche. There were similarities, certainly, but there are, sadly, hundreds of young women killed each year in the United States. Many of them are strangled, bludgeoned, and raped. The method of murder was not enough to assume that any one man was responsible for a particular group of victims. Ted's name was now listed four times in that endless computer readout in the Washington State Task Force office. But he was still one among several thousand, a man with no adult criminal record at all, and certainly a man whose job record and educational background did not stamp him as a criminal type. He had been in Washington, and now he was in Utah. His name was Ted, and he drove a Volkswagen. His girlfriend Meg had been suspicious enough to turn him in, but Meg was a very jealous woman. A woman who had been lied to. There were a score or more jealous women who had turned their boyfriends' names in as possible Teds. It was after that 1974 Intermountain Conference, after more urging from Lynn Banks, that Meg Anders had gone a step further. She placed a call to the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office and repeated her suspicions about Ted Bundy. Her voice had had a near hysterical edge to it. And Captain Hayward, too, suspected that this woman on the long-distance line from Seattle was exaggerating, was allowing herself to see connections that were, at best, tenuous. He wrote down the name Ted Bundy and gave it to Jerry Thompson to add to the burgeoning list of Utah suspects. Without physical evidence, without solid information, detectives cannot rush out and arrest a man. It goes against the grain of our whole philosophy of justice. It would be 8 months before Ted Bundy would, through his own actions, place himself squarely in the eye of the law, would almost challenge police to stop him. What do I remember of the Christmas season of 1974? Very little. There was no reason to. I remember that I was back at work 2 weeks after surgery, a recuperation compounded by a bout with the flu. I couldn't drive yet. But a few of the detectives had taken their free time to tape the vital information on some of their cases which had already been to trial, and they drove out to bring me the tapes so that I could type stories at home. I remember that the following January brought one wailing windstorm, a storm that whipped across Puget Sound and hit our old beach house with such force that the living room window all across the southern wall was blown in, scattering plants, lamps, and glass shards 20 feet into the room. It looked like a tornado had danced through, and we froze until we could get someone out to put in a new window. That was the month the basement flooded, and the roof started to leak in several spots. I can remember being very discouraged, but I can't remember once thinking about Ted Bundy. Ted came back to Seattle in January of 1975 and spent more than a week with Meg from January 14th to 23rd, after he had finished his final exams in Utah. Meg didn't tell him that she had turned his name into the police,
and she carried a heavy burden of guilt, although no officer had yet approached him. He was so nice to her, and was seriously talking marriage again, and her doubts of the fall just past now seemed to be only a nightmare. This was the old Ted, the man she had loved for so many years. She was able to put her fears somewhere far back in her mind. The only woman in Utah that he mentioned to her was Callie Fiore, whom he described as flaky. He said that there'd been a goodbye party for Callie sometime after Christmas of 1974, that they'd seen her off on a plane. He didn't mention that Callie hadn't left for good, that she was coming back to Salt Lake City. When Ted left to go back to law school, Meg felt much better. There were plans for her to visit him in Salt Lake City that summer, and he promised to come back to Seattle as soon as he could. Karen Campbell had vacationed in Aspen, Colorado in January of 1975. Karen, a registered nurse, was engaged to Dr. Raymond Godowski of Farmington, Michigan, and the pair, along with Godowski's two children by a prior marriage, were combining a pleasure trip with a medical symposium on cardiology that Godowski was scheduled to attend in Aspen. The group checked into the plush Wildwood Inn on January 11th and was given a room on the second floor. At 23, Karen was 9 years younger than Godowski, but she loved him and she got along well with his son, Gregory, 11, and his daughter, Jenny, 9. She wanted to get married, and soon. When the couple argued that day, it was because Godowski was not particularly anxious to rush into a second marriage. Karen Campbell was suffering with a slight case of the flu when they arrived, but she was still able to take the youngsters skiing and sightseeing while Godowski attended seminars. On January 12th, they ate dinner with friends at the Stew Pot, and Karen ordered beef stew. The others had cocktails, but Karen, still feeling queasy, drank only milk. And then Karen, Godowski, and the youngsters returned to the cozy lounge at the Wildwood Inn. Godowski picked up the evening paper, and Karen, remembering that she'd left a new magazine in their room, headed toward the elevator to get it. She carried with her the only key to room 210. All things being equal, she should have returned to the lounge within 10 minutes. Karen got off the elevator on the second floor and spoke to several other physicians waiting there, doctors she'd met at the convention. They watched her walk down the hall toward her room. Downstairs, Godowski finished the paper and glanced around. His children were playing contentedly, but Karen hadn't come back. He looked toward the elevators, expecting to see her emerge at any moment. The minutes dragged, and she didn't appear. Warning the youngsters to stay in the lounge, the young cardiologist went up to their room, and then remembered that Karen had the key. He knocked and waited for her to cross the room and open the door. She didn't. He knocked again, thinking that perhaps she was in the bathroom and hadn't heard him. Knocked louder. Still, she didn't open the door. He felt a prickling of alarm. If she had gotten sicker, perhaps fainted inside, she might have hit her head on something, might be unconscious. He sprinted down to the desk, obtained a duplicate key, and ran back to the second floor. The door swung open, and the room before him looked exactly as it had when they'd left before dinner. There was no sign of Karen's purse, and the magazine that she'd meant to get was still on the stand beside the beds. Obviously, she hadn't come up to the room at all. Puzzled and indecisive, he stood in the empty room, the key in his hand. Then he turned and walked out into the hallway, locking the door behind him. There were a lot of parties going on that Sunday night, and he figured that his fiancée had probably run into some of their friends, been enticed to stop someplace for just one drink. She wasn't usually inconsiderate, and she must have known he'd be worried. But then the atmosphere in the lodge was an easygoing one. He checked back in the lounge and found the children still alone. Godowski paced, hurrying faster and faster from one bar in the sprawling building to another, listening for the sound of Karen's laughter, looking for the familiar way she tossed back her hair. The din and the ebullient spirits of the people around him seemed to mock him. Karen was gone, simply gone. And he couldn't understand it. He gathered up his youngsters and took them to the room. It was 10 p.m. now, and outside the big warm lodge, it was freezing cold. All Karen had been wearing when she'd strolled toward the elevator were blue jeans, her light brown woolly jacket, and boots. That was warm enough during the day, but it was inconceivable that she'd gone out into the January Colorado night like that.
Godowski called the Aspen Police Department shortly after 10. The patrolman who arrived took a missing report, but they assured the Michigan doctor that almost everybody who disappeared showed up after the bars and parties broke up. Godowski shook his head impatiently. No, she isn't like that. She was ill. She may have gotten sicker. A description of the nurse was broadcast to patrolmen on duty in Aspen. 23-year-old woman, 5 feet 4 inches tall, brown shoulder-length hair, the clothes she was wearing. Many times during the night, patrol units would pull up to a young woman wearing jeans, a woolly jacket, only to find that it was someone else. It was never Karen Campbell. By morning, Godowski was distraught after a sleepless night, the children crying and upset. Aspen police detectives moved through the Wildwood Inn, searching room by room, storerooms, closets, even the kitchens, and up through crawl spaces, peering down into the elevator shafts. The pretty nurse wasn't anywhere in the lodge. They questioned every guest, but no one had seen Karen Campbell after she'd said hi to the group at the elevator on the second floor and walked down the hall toward a room. Finally, Dr. Godowski packed up their bags and flew home with his children, hoping each time the phone rang that it would somehow be Karen, with a logical explanation of why she had walked away from him. The call never came. On February 18th, a recreational employee working along the Owl Creek Road a few miles from the Wildwood Inn noticed a flight of squawking birds that were circling something in a snowbank 25 feet off the road. He walked through the melting drifts and turned away, sickened. What remained of Karen Campbell's nude body lay there in the snow, snow-stained crimson with her blood. Pathologist Dr. Donald Clark performed a post-mortem examination on the body that dental records verified was Karen's. She had died of repeated blunt instrument blows to her skull and had, in addition, suffered deep cuts from a sharp weapon, a knife, an axe. There was not enough tissue left in the neck area to say whether she had been strangled, but her hyoid bone had been cracked. It was much too late to tell if she had been subjected to a sexual attack, but the nude condition of her body pointed to rape as a strong motive. Undigested bits of stew and milk were easily identifiable in her stomach. Karen Campbell had been killed within hours after she had eaten on January 12th, which would make time of death shortly after she had left the lounge of the Wildwood Inn to go up to her room. She had never made it to her room, or if she had, someone had waited inside for her. That seemed unlikely. The room had shown no signs of struggle at all. Somewhere along that well-lighted corridor on the second floor of the Wildwood Inn, somewhere between the elevators and room 210, Karen had met her killer and had seemingly gone with him without a fight. It was a disappearance reminiscent of the Georgianne Hawkins case in June of 1974. Less than 50 feet to walk to safety, and then gone. One California woman tourist had been in that corridor of the Wildwood Inn on the night of January 12th, and she had seen a handsome young man who had smiled at her, but she thought nothing of it. She had left for home before Karen Campbell's disappearance became known to other hotel guests. The winter waned, and back in Washington State, the snows had begun to melt and slough off in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains. On Saturday, March 1st, 1975, two Green River Community College students were working on a forestry survey project on Taylor Mountain, a thickly wooded mini-mountain east of Highway 18, a two-lane highway that cuts through forests between Auburn and North Bend, Washington. The site is about 10 miles from the hillside where the remains of Janice Ott, Denise Nasland, and an unidentified third person, perhaps fourth, were located in September of 1974. It was slow going through the moss-shrouded alders, the ground carpeted with sword ferns and fallen leaves. One of the forestry students looked down. A human skull rested at his feet. Brenda Ball had been found at last, although it would take dental records to verify that. As they had 6 months before, King County police detectives immediately ordered the lonely area cordoned off, and again Detective Bob Keppel led over 200 searchers into the area. Men and dogs moved with painstaking slowness through the dank forest, turning over piles of leaves, rotten stumps. Denise and Janice had been found only a few miles from the park where they vanished. Brenda's skull was discovered 30 miles away from the Flame Tavern. This could perhaps be explained by the fact that she'd intended to hitchhike to Sun Lake State Park east of the mountains. Highway 18 would have been a likely alternate route to Snoqualmie Pass. Had she gotten into a car with the stranger with a sling on his arm, grateful that she had a ride all the way to Sun Lakes? And had he then pulled over, stopped in this desolate region, and stared at her with the pitiless eyes of a killer? The discovery of the skull on Taylor Mountain made some kind of macabre sense, but that was all there was to be found of the dark-eyed girl. Even if animals had scattered the remainder of her skeleton, there should have been something more, and there was nothing. No more bones, not so much as a tattered rag of her clothing. Cause of death was impossible to determine, but the skull was fractured on the left side, smashed by a blunt instrument. The grim search went on for 2 more days. Early on March 3rd, Bob Keppel slipped and fell as he made his way down a slimy incline. He had stumbled, literally, over another skull 100 feet away from that of Brenda Ball. Dental records would confirm that Keppel had found all that was left of Susan Rancourt, the shy blonde co-ed who had vanished from Ellensburg, 87 miles away. There was no reason at all for Susan to be here in this lonely grove. It appeared that the killer had established his own graveyard, bringing only his victim's severed heads with him month after month. It was an ugly supposition to contemplate, but one that could not be ignored. Susan's skull, too, had been brutally fractured. As the search went on, the other families waited, dreading that their daughters might be up on Taylor Mountain, that they would hear a knock on their door at any time. 50 feet more of the tedious sifting of wet leaves, brushing aside dripping sword ferns, and there was yet another skull. Dental records confirmed this victim was a girl the detectives hadn't expected to find so far away from home. It was that of Roberta Kathleen Parks, missing since the previous May from Corvallis, Oregon, 262 miles away. As with the others, it bore the crushing damage of a blunt instrument. The first to vanish was the last to be found. Linda Ann Healy, the teacher of retarded youngsters, gone 14 months from her basement room in the university district, could be identified only by her lower mandible. The fillings in the jawbone matched Linda's dental charts. Linda's skull, too, had been carried to Taylor Mountain. Although the search continued from dawn until sunset for another week, no more skulls were found, no clothes, no jewelry. There had been a few dozen small bones, neck bones, but not nearly enough to indicate that the victim's complete bodies had been carried into the forest, and the realization that only the girls' heads had been brought there one at a time over a 6-month period brought forth more rumors of cults, witchcraft, and Satanism. Seattle police had a file, File 1004, a file on occult happenings. Reports came into the beleaguered task force, reports from people who thought they'd seen Ted at cult gatherings. In any case, with such widespread publicity, a number of kooks will surface, advancing theories that make an ordinary man's hair stand up on the back of his neck. There were totally unsubstantiated rumors that the missing and murdered girls had been sacrificed and their headless bodies dumped, weighted into the almost bottomless waters of Lake Washington. A psychic from Eastern Washington contacted Captain Herb Swindler and prevailed upon him to meet with her at dawn on the Taylor Mountain site, where the woman pierced the ground with a stick and attempted to deduce information from the way it cast shadows. It was an eerie scene, and it produced no new theories. Swindler was soon besieged by messages from those who claimed direct contact with that other world, and almost as many requests from other departments with crimes they felt might have resulted from devil worship. The man was a no-nonsense cop, and he was hassled by his detectives who thought the psychic angle was ridiculous. But Swindler kept remembering the astrological prediction that had come true on July 14th. Asked if he felt the occult was involved, he shook his head.
I don't know. I've never known.
Psychiatrists were more inclined to believe that the killer was a man obsessed by a terrible compulsion, a compulsion that forced him to hunt down and kill the same type of woman over and over and over again, that he could never be able to murder her enough times to find surcease. Over at County Police Headquarters, Captain Nick Mackey admitted that the crimes might never be solved. The Probers knew now that Linda, Susan, Kathy, Brenda, Denise, and Janice were dead. As to the fate of Donna and Georgiane, they were in the dark. There were still the extra femur bones found with Denise and Janice. They probably belonged to the missing women. It was all they were ever to know. Donna Manson and Georgiane Hawkins may never be found. In Utah, it is the same with Debbie Kent. Gone.
The name of the game is tenacity, Mackey remarked. We have looked at 2,247 Ted lookalikes, 916 vehicles.
Mackey said that there were 200 suspects left after the winnowing out, but 200 is still an impossibly large number of men to learn everything about.
We have no crime scene evidence, no positive means of death, Mackey said. It's the worst case I've ever been on. There's just nothing.
Mackey added that a psychological profile of the killer indicated that he would probably have criminal behavior in his background, was probably a sexual psychopath.
You go up to a certain point in your investigation,
the weary detective chief commented.
Then you stop and start all over again.
Ted Bundy's name remained on the roster of 200 suspects. But Ted Bundy had no criminal background. He was squarely on the other side of the law from all the information the task force had uncovered on him. His juvenile records were shredded, and they didn't know of his long-ago arrests for car theft and burglary. Meg hadn't told them that she knew Ted had stolen television sets, even while he was an honor student at the university. There was a great deal she hadn't yet told them. Just as the crimes had stopped in Washington, they stopped in Utah. The murder of Karen Campbell in Aspen was another state away and appeared to be an isolated instance. Detective Mike Fisher in Aspen was busy checking out local suspects, eliminating every man who had known the pretty nurse. He could see no link with the Utah cases, and Washington State was a long, long way away. Crime news was about to escalate in Colorado. Vail, Colorado, is 100 miles away from Aspen, a booming ski resort town, but without the flash, money, the drugs, and the laissez-faire attitude of Aspen. Jerry Ford keeps a vacation condo in Vail, and Cary Grant occasionally flies in quietly with his daughter Jennifer to ski. Jim Stovall, chief of detectives of the Salem, Oregon Police Department, takes his winter vacation there, working as a ski instructor. His daughter lives there, also a ski instructor. Stovall drew a deep breath as he recalled to me that 26-year-old Julie Cunningham was a good friend of his daughter, and Stovall, who has solved so many Oregon homicides, was at a loss to know what had happened to Julie on the night of March 15th. At 26, Julie Cunningham should have had the world by the tail. She was very attractive, and she had silky dark hair parted in the middle. She shared a pleasant apartment in Vail with a girlfriend and worked as a clerk in a sporting goods store and as a part-time ski instructor. But Julie wasn't happy. She was searching for the one man she could really love and trust, someone to settle down with. She'd done the ski bum bit, but she was growing out of that. She wanted marriage and children. Julie was not the best judge of men. She believed their lines, and she was becoming disillusioned. She'd heard, "It's been great, I'll give you a call someday," much too often. Maybe Vail was the wrong place for her to be. Maybe the aura of a ski town didn't lend itself to permanent relationships. In early March of 1975, Julie was to suffer her last heartbreak. She thought she had met the man she wanted, and she was thrilled when he invited her to go to Sun Valley with him for a vacation. But she'd been dumped on again when they reached the resort made famous by Sonia Henie movies in the 30s. The man had never had any intention of a committed relationship, and she returned to Vail, crying and depressed. On the Saturday night of March 15th, Julie didn't have a date. She called her mother that evening, feeling a little better when she hung up just before 9. She decided to get out of her apartment, and wearing blue jeans, a brown suede jacket, boots, and a ski cap, headed for a tavern a few blocks away. Her roommate was there. She could have a beer or two. There was always tomorrow. Only there wasn't. There were no more tomorrows for Julie Cunningham. She didn't arrive at the tavern, and when her roommate came home in the early morning hours, Julie wasn't there. Julie's clothes, books, records, makeup, everything but what she'd worn when she walked out were there, but their owner never returned. Julie Cunningham's disappearance was soon eclipsed in the news by an event in Aspen. Claudine Langer, the divorced wife of singer Andy Williams, was arrested for the March 19th slaying of her lover, Spider Savage, a former world champion skier. The lover's quarrel, the notoriety of the principals, made much bigger headlines than the disappearance of an unknown ski instructor. But the pattern was repeating, just as it had in Washington a year earlier. A victim in January, no victim in February, a victim in March. Would there be a victim in April in Colorado? Denise Oliverson was 25 years old that spring, married and living in Grand Junction, Colorado, a town just east of the Utah-Colorado border on Highway 70. Denise argued with her husband on Sunday afternoon, April 6th, and left their home, riding her yellow bike, headed for her parents' home. She may have grown less angry with each mile that passed. It was a wonderful spring day, and perhaps she realized that their fight had been silly. Maybe she planned to go home and make up that night. It was a warm day, and Denise wore jeans and a print green long-sleeved blouse. If anyone saw the pretty dark-haired woman pedaling her 10-speed that afternoon, they have never come forward to report it. Denise didn't arrive at her folks' place, but they hadn't been expecting her. She didn't come home that night either, and her husband figured she was still angry with him. He would give her time to cool off and then call. On Monday, he called her parents and was startled to learn she had never arrived at their home. A search of the route she had probably taken was instituted, and police discovered her bike and her sandals beneath a viaduct near a railroad bridge close by the Colorado River on US 50. The bike was in good working order. There would have been no reason to leave it there. Like Julie Cunningham, Denise Oliverson had disappeared. There would be other girls who had vanished in Colorado during that bright spring of 1975. 18-year-old Melanie Cooley, who looked enough like bountiful Utah's Debbie Kent to have been a twin, walked away from her high school in Nederland, a tiny mountain hamlet 50 miles west of Denver, on April 15th. 8 days later, county road workers found her battered body on the Coal Creek Canyon Road 20 miles away. She had been bludgeoned on the back of the head, probably with a rock, and her hands were tied. A filthy pillowcase, perhaps used as a garrote, perhaps as a blindfold, was still twisted around her neck. On July 1st, Shelley K. Robertson, 24, failed to show up for work in Golden, Colorado. Her family checked around and discovered she had been seen alive on Monday, June 30th, by friends. A police officer had seen her in a service station in Golden on July 1st, in the company of a wild-haired man driving an old pickup truck. No one saw her after that. Shelley had been a hitchhiker, and her family tried to believe that she had decided to take off on a whim for a visit to another state. But as the summer passed with no word from her at all, that seemed unlikely. On August 21st, Shelley's nude body was discovered 500 feet inside a mine at the foot of Bertoud Pass by two mining students. Decomposition was far advanced, making cause of death impossible to determine. Almost 100 miles from Denver, the mine is quite close to Vail. The mine was searched on the possibility that Julie Cunningham's body might be hidden inside, but she was not found. And then it was over. There were no more victims, or if there were, they were young women whose vanishing was not reported to police. In each jurisdiction, the detectives had checked out relatives, friends, known sex criminals, and eliminated them all through polygraph examinations or alibis. Of all the Western victims, there was not one who had short hair, not one who could be described as anything but beautiful, and not one who would have gone away willingly with a complete stranger. Even the girls who had been known to hitchhike had been cautious. Yet there is a common denominator in almost every instance. Something in the victims' lives had gone awry on the days they vanished, something that would tend to make them distracted and therefore easy prey for a clever killer. Brenda Baker and Kathy Devine were both running away from home. Linda Ann Healy had been ill. Donna Manson was suffering from depression. Susan Rancourt was alone on campus at night for the very first time ever. Roberta Kathleen Parks was depressed and upset over her father's illness. Georgianne Hawkins was extremely worried about passing her Spanish final. Janice Ott was lonely for her husband and depressed on that Sunday in July. Denise Naslund had had a fight with her boyfriend. Of the Washington women, only Brenda Ball had been her usual good-natured self the last time her friends saw her. Yet patrons at the Flame Tavern recall that she was worried because she'd been unable to find a ride home that night. In Utah, Carol Durant was a naive, too-trusting girl. Laura Aim was a little drunk, disappointed at the fizzle of her party plans for Halloween. Debbie Kent was worried about her father's recent heart attack and anxious to protect him from worry. Melissa Smith was concerned about her friend's broken heart and probably was thinking about their conversation as she left the pizza parlor. The Colorado victims, too, had other things on their minds. Karen Campbell had had an argument with her fiancé over their prolonged engagement, and she was ill. Julie Cunningham was depressed over a failed romance. Denise Oliverson had had a fight with her husband. And Shelley K. Robertson had argued with her boyfriend the weekend before she vanished. The thoughts of Melanie Cooley are not known. The most basic bit of advice given to women who have to walk alone at night is, look alert, be aware of your surroundings, and walk briskly. You will be safer if you know where you are going and if anyone who observes you senses that. Had the man who approached these young women divined somehow that he had come upon his victims at a time when they were particularly vulnerable, when they were not thinking as clearly as they usually did? It would almost seem so. The stalking, predatory animal cuts the weakest from the pack and then kills at his leisure. Chapter 15. In May of 1975, Ted Bundy had invited some old friends from the Washington State Department of Emergency Services to visit him at his apartment on First Avenue in Salt Lake City.